Welcome to In Search of Insight, Nootropics Depot's monthly podcast. I'm your podcast host, Erica, and sitting next to me is our product specialist at Nootropics Depot, Emil.
Hey, everyone. And today we're joined by a very special guest. Many of you might not know him by face or even by his real name, Joshua. You'll probably know him by Mr. Happy from the Longevity days and the Mr. Happy stack. So today is an episode going back in time. We're going to talk about the early days of Nootropics. I've been in it for about 10 years now, but Joshua has been in it for much longer, knows Paul quite well, and is just an important part, I think, of the Nootropics journey that we've all been on, and I think is one of the people who laid the foundation for all of us to enjoy Nootropics how they are now. So welcome, Joshua.
Thank you, Emil and Erica.
I think a lot of our viewers, you're very familiar with Reddit. A lot of you probably learned most of what you know about Nootropics on Reddit and research links from there. But back in the day, we didn't have Reddit how we have it now. We had other forums, forums that are slowly starting to disappear now. But one of the bigger ones was Longevity, which, what does it stand for again? Longevity City? Was that what it was?
My recollection was it was based on something like that. It was a foundation. It was quite a. It had very noble aspirations, and it really was dedicated towards, you know, trying to solve a number of problems using nootropics and various other life extension tools and interventions. So it was quite a unique place for quite a long time before, you know, larger platforms like Reddit came along and replaced them all. Mm-hmm. And no, that's not to say that Reddit has ended up being a wonderful place to host any of these communities in the long term, but, you know, unfortunately, that's what happens with critical mass over a period of time.
It does. And I think that's why Longevity was so unique, because it was a much more niche, small group of people that were in it. And it's one of the first forums that I kind of got introduced to everything. I think when I first started looking at supplements, I was about 16. So that's 14 years ago now, and I think that's kind of in the heyday of forums like Longevity. And I think that's where I got my first recommendations from. So I think the first thing I ever took was ginkgo biloba, and I think I read about it on Longevity, and I went to the local pharmacy, and I found some, and I started taking it together with a cup of coffee and studying, and I felt like a very cool 16-year-old at that point, that I was taking some nootropics, and then that actually ended up informing my decision to go study psychology and then a bit of neuroscience. And that's when my hobby really picked up, just reading through Longevity and reading some of your threads too. But it was a group of, yeah, a very interesting group of people, I think, on there, very knowledgeable.
Yeah, pioneers who were dedicated to exploring some of the fringe areas and not being not concerned, but, you know, being cautiously optimistic in how they were self-experimenting with a number of, you know, these different compounds and nootropics and supplements and things. So it's interesting, like that really was the, you know, the early days and the foundations of, you know, what we have today. Mm-hmm. It's interesting, actually. I think, you know, looking back on those days, the things that we used to do back then were, you know, fairly novel. Like, we were exploring, you know, different compounds that were known in certain articles or certain research circles to have effects in other animals, but not well studied in humans. Sometimes the, you know, the pharmacokinetics and some of these things were not well established. But, you know, it would typically follow some sort of trend. There'd be some sort of fad. There'd be a hype train. Some compound would get, you know, everyone all excited. And then, you know, 15 people or, you know, 20 people might suddenly jump in and find a chemist or someone to synthesize a compound. And then people would go about a very unregulated, unscientific, statistically insignificant round of testing to try to understand, you know, how these different compounds interacted with our, you know, our biochemistry and a very personal.
And what kind of testing were you doing at that time?
I mean, a lot of it was not just subjective testing. There would be, you know, if there was certain biomarkers and things that would be, you know, interesting relative to some of those compounds, then they would be followed up on. And that might be things like neurotransmitter levels. That might be certain blood markers, you know, certain, you know, metabolites. But for the most part in those days, I don't think everyone always had access to Be able to actually do all the testing that I would expect to be standard at this point in time. And I think, everybody these days would normally, follow through with. It's interesting. I mean, you certainly couldn't rule out placebo and nocebo effects. It really wasn't well run, but it certainly was a very interesting time, a bit of the wild, wild west of nootropics and supplements.
So. And to put it into context for everyone, now it's really easy. You can go to Nootropics Depot or Thorne or some of these other websites, and you can very easily pick up a large array of different compounds, botanical extracts, things like that. But back then, you didn't have it. Like, I remember one really interesting post on Longevity. I think it was a guy called Mad Scientist or something similar. He had found colurestam in a research paper, and he really wanted to try it. So I think he spent something like $50,000 synthesizing a few grams of it. Like, this person was just really wealthy and had the means to just spend $50,000 on a few grams of a research nootropic. He tried it on himself, and he was writing about it on the forum. And I think that's how we learned a lot about the effects in humans, because like Joshua was saying, a lot of these compounds were being studied in animals, and we had no idea what they would actually feel like for a human being. So some of these unique effects, like, oh, colurestam seems to enhance your visual acuity, we could have never guessed that through an animal study, and we needed someone as crazy as Mad Scientist to synthesize this compound and maybe give us an idea, okay, this is what happens when you enhance the CHAT enzyme, choline acetyltransferase. And then, or what was the other mechanism? It had like a high affinity choline uptake. I think that was HACU.
That was another one that was hypothesized. And I can't remember what the data was supporting that in the long term. yeah, it's interesting. All of those racetams, and they're always in a subtly different footprint. Mm-hmm. They all have very slightly different effects. And, there are all sorts of different hypotheses around why some people get certain, like side effects, like headaches and things like that on certain racetams and not others. And, there was all sorts of bro science around that about, oh, well, you need to take 2 grams of choline a day with that, or you're going to get, all these different effects. And unfortunately, look, that's, a bit of fanboyism and a little bit of hope, I think.
I think so too. And the funny thing is, we see this happening again now. So we've had this whole generation, I think, that came up on this super experimental Wild Wild West stuff. I think we realized it was a bit unsustainable, and we looked towards perhaps, a bit more basic things, like building out your micronutrients, your sleep, like in a sense, maybe going a bit more boring and less exotic, but I think long-term effects, it's important. But we see it happening again now. There's a whole new generation of people that are kind of at the age range we were probably back then, that are now looking to the next best thing. They're getting back into the peptides, they're getting back into the exotic research compounds. And it's funny to kind of see it happening all over again, but also to kind of see the cockiness and arrogance of that new generation. And that's probably what we were doing back then too. We thought we were gods walking on earth,
I think it's also important there to make the distinction between exploring compounds to enhance an already optimal baseline versus, trying to take compounds to ultimately reach a normal baseline, and perhaps not even realizing that your current baseline is not your standard baseline because something is inhibiting your metabolism in certain ways. And that's, I think something that, wasn't done enough. And these days, like, you'll see people that will be on Reddit or whatever talking about taking a particular compound, because they want to promote dopamine and they want, they want a particular effect without kind of just doing the research and running the test and say, well, hey, is there a possible reason that my pathway for that particular neurotransmitter or metabolite might be, not performing very well? Looking at things like the intracellular minerals, looking at what might be happening in the microbiome or the immune system. All of these different things that might be creating a chronic effect that ultimately would be inhibiting their basal, levels of these metabolites before trying to, promote them to the, to the sky with some exotic compound. Mm-hmm. So
it sounds like, from how you're describing the early days of these forums, that the world of general supplements, maybe vitamins, minerals, and then the world of these experimental products, compounds, were quite separate. But it seems to me, at least because of what Nootropics Depot offers now, as well as other companies, that perhaps those are coming a little bit closer together. Like what you're saying, perhaps there's a reason, or maybe a more approachable way to start, rather than going straight for an exotic compound when it comes to promoting a particular neurotransmitter.
That's exactly right. And I think, you know, I would coach towards collecting data before doing anything. Establish what the baseline is, and that way you can actually quantify if you're having results from using a particular compound or strategy towards trying to enhance a pathway or a particular outcome. You know, data equals good decisions. No data is just, yeah, mush, mush and fluff.
And were you already taking that approach back in the longevity days? Like data collection, or was it a bit more guesswork at that point?
In those days, yeah, it was difficult because certain things were hard to get data on. You know, and you would rely sometimes on subjective experiences across a number of people, and then trying to, you know, ascertain a trend towards a particular effect, or either like a good effect, like a good outcome, or a particular side effect, and then try to establish if there were variables that might contribute to that state. But of course, the amount of guesswork and inference created by a lack of data makes the outcomes entirely unreliable. At most, you get a, you know, like a blurry sort of, you know, outline of an idea that something may, you know, end up in a particular direction or have a particular effect, but you don't actually have the ability to say, okay, yeah, I can absolutely say that this particular compound at this particular amount per day via this route equals a percentage increase in this particular metabolite, you know, across, you know, this particular window. All these sorts of things that, you know, you would love to know, or hope that there, you know, may have been literature that existed to actually set your expectations around that. So yeah, it's certainly a lot easier these days to make better decisions, and to, you know, really sort of strive towards harm minimization and risk minimization for people who, you know, want to experiment with you know, compounds that should be safe under normal circumstances. Or might be slightly exotic, and you know, possibly it's something that, you know, they want to study, knowing that there is a, you know, an element of risk, even if it's not a long term risk, about how, you know, these compounds might perform in their body.
Yeah.
So,
And I think that's one of the things that, when I came across your post on longevity, the Mr. Happy Stack thread, which I'm not sure what it was called anymore. Do you remember what the thread was called?
Uridine, alpha GPC, and choline. I think that was it, or DHA. I mean, this is going back to 2011. Unfortunately, yeah. My memory, well, there's a long story around that, but yeah, my memory after, you know, the last few months, a bit of a blur. I've been kind of burning the candle at both ends for about the last 2 years on some of my more recent work. So just kind of coming back from a bit of leave and you know, perhaps a few alcoholic beverages and some other things, trying to reset some of these things. But yeah, it was certainly, I think it was an 83-page long, I think, thread.
It was very long, yeah.
Blew up. And then it was very interesting, actually. There was, it became so popular, people were having some really good results with it. And then a number of companies stepped forward and started producing products, even putting username on the product label and capitalizing on that, of course, with no discussion, with no, you know, no yeah, interest in basically even a conversation with me around it. So it was I'm trying to think, there were a couple of brands anyway, probably not worthwhile promoting any brands, you know,
if they still even exist at this point, because a lot of those exist. Initial companies went down. I think we're kind of from that time frame, one of the people that stayed around and played the game well, because yeah. I think a lot of our competitors were doing very risky things that was like claiming that certain supplements help with certain diseases online, which is not
that's huge. No.
Yeah.
And look, the other thing was just I think the quality of the products. I mean, one of the things that really came out of the Wild Wild West days was the fact that even if you're having a, you know, a chemist synthesize a particular compound, you still have an element of trust that compound is actually what it is on the label. And so being able to do, you know, proper like qualitative and quantitative analysis of a compound, you know, and look at, you know, what else might be in there, any other, you know, unlabeled ingredients or heavy metals, contaminants, things like that, or simply a bad synthesis is just critical, you know. And there have been quite a number of cowboys on the market. And I think that's kind of been one of the things that's really set Nootropics Depot, you know, out into its own, well, own area ahead of, you know, any of the other competition, has been the fact that, you know, the ethos has been around that quality of product. You know, and I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but that was where, you know, Nootropics Depot really started.
Correct. So Paul was also really active and wanted to try all of these different things. And then a few times there was kind of an indication of what they were getting was not really what it should have been. Like something should have been giving a slightly stimulating effect, but it was giving a really calming effect. That's kind of strange. Maybe it's down to personal chemistry. Maybe the compound wasn't pure. Maybe it was completely mislabeled. And Paul wasn't alone in this. Quite a few people started mentioning this. The sentiment was there on longevity too. Like, how much can we trust some of these things? So one thing Paul did very early on, he set up a community fund where they would donate some money into a fund. Paul would go out and he would buy one of these products, and then he would send it off to a testing lab. I think at the time we were using Chimeric Labs a lot. I'm not sure if they're even around anymore, but that's kind of where it all started. And we started doing the testing, or Paul started doing the testing, completely separate from any company at this point. He was just a private person interested exploring. It was the Wild West, and this was another thing that we could do to explore. And what we found out, or what Paul found out, is that a lot of things weren't exactly what they claimed they were. Some were just outright fake. Things were underdosed. Things were not pure. Things were contaminated with heavy metals. Some products were just downright unsafe. For example, we caught some, it was supposed to be pyritinol, which is a vitamin B6 derivative, but it ended up being diphenhydramine powder, which is Benadryl. I mean, even just for a vendor to sell diphenhydramine powder, I think is very illegal because it's an over-the-counter drug. So not testing put the companies in a lot of legal problems potentially, and it presented a health risk to the consumers. And that's, I think, where the harm reduction element came in. And Paul, at a certain point, started to realize, like, some of these things that I want to be taking, they're just not there consistently. And that's when Serotropic started. And I think it was really simple. Like, one of the first products was an L-theanine solution. It was that simple. But that's where the catalog grew. And I think now we're at like 300 plus unique products. So over the last 10 years, a lot has changed, and we've built out our own lab, and kind of Paul's first vision of making everyone a little bit more responsible for their actions, sellers and people consuming these compounds, I think it's playing out now a little bit more. People are more aware of lab testing. They're more aware of certificates of analysis. And now you can actually find things that are passing testing quite consistently, our own products and some of our competitors too. But that's an interesting thing, like back in the early longevity days. And I remember when I was in college reading about the Mr. Happy Stack, I really wanted to try it too. But where do I go and find all of these different things? Powder City was one source. I think most of us were probably getting the majority of our stuff from Powder City. I think they were really the top dog at the time. What they were selling, I'm not sure, but
they were definitely a very helpful vendor around that period. And it's funny, I haven't actually even checked to see if they still exist at this point in time. I don't know.
They don't. No. So the website is technically still up, but Powder City itself went under, I think, around 2015. Like it already happened pretty early on. And then it got bought out by someone. I think like two guys bought it out for quite a lot of money, and then resold it for a lot of money. And then it went to this guy who was also running like a sketchy Kratom website, and he would like redirect people from the Powder City listings to his listing. So it looked like the Powder City website was up, but when you added something in your cart and you went to check out, it took you to his website. And then I think he actually ended up getting arrested for some sketchy stuff with the Kratom, and it was a whole mess. So I think the Powder City website might still be up, but it's definitely not the actual Powder City anymore, and I wouldn't trust them. And at the time, like, they were one of the more trustworthy vendors.
Trustworthy vendors.
I remember even getting some Tangat Ali from them. It was like a 2% urocomonone extract. No one had heard of that. Everyone was doing the ratio extracts, but then they said, hey, you know what? Ratio extracts are bullshit. Here's a 2% urocomonone. And that's kind of the first time I started hearing those sentiments. And this is before I was at Nootropics Depot. So a lot of that was already in my mind. And when I joined Nootropics Depot, I was very refreshed to hear that that's exactly what Paul was saying too. And we're all on the same page. And we took that vision further and further to the point where we have a crazy lab now. Which, if you're ever in Arizona, you're welcome to tour the lab, and maybe we can film a video there. It's
I look forward to that.
Just a place.
Really good things.
Yeah.
Well, that'll be good. It's really interesting. That product purity issue has been such a problem. And, like, even just, like, up until recently, I think there's some changes happening on Amazon, but one of the things that was really disheartening was how many faked products you would find. They would be in a bottle with labels. They would look almost identical, if not identical, to the original vendor's product. Mm-hmm. And it would be something. So it would be it. And it's that was such an issue that I was going out of my way not to use Amazon for a source, as it was coming directly from an Amazon store that happened to be coming from that vendor itself. Yeah. And I see that Amazon stepped forward now, and I think moving forward, there's going to be a requirement for, like, a COA for every product for you to be able to list it, which I think is a significant step forward, you know, in actually, again, harm reduction.
And technically that's true. And we would love to actually see that being implemented properly. But in practice, because this has been going on for a few years already, but there's brands like Tonic on Amazon that we know for sure a lot of their stuff is not what they're claiming. We've tested some of their things. We've actually reported them to Amazon a few times, and Amazon doesn't really do anything with it. Because, you know, on the one hand, we want to make sure that everyone is getting the proper things to take, but we also need to be competitive as a business. So if all of our competitors are basically selling ground up houseplants in capsules and selling it for the same amount that we're selling, like, they're obviously going to be the ones winning, because they can have it cheaper, they can make a lot more money, they can then reinvest that money into sketchy marketing strategies where, like, they'll put little notes in the bottle like, hey, if you give us a 5-star review on Amazon, we'll give you a free bottle, which is totally against Amazon's terms and services. But that's why some of these products you'll see hundreds of 5-star reviews, because people will order a bottle, they'll see this, they'll make a review, and now they just got a free bottle of something. We do still see a lot of weird stuff happening there, but it has gotten better. And luckily there are some brands out there that are good, like Foreign is really good. We're obviously really good. And so now there's at least more reputable vendors around.
I think that's the key thing. At some point, you kind of just got to look at the, you know, the overall benefit and the risk in your product choices and your vendor sources. And look, Nootropics Depot has never, as far as I've ever seen, has never really put a foot wrong. You know, there hasn't been any scandals we've seen with, you know, some of the other very large brands. Mm-hmm. You know, the care in the actual final quality of the product is definitely, you know, something that other companies should, I think, should describe to or aspire to.
Just to give an idea of how anal we can be about these things, we were making isoliquitogenin tablets, and I think they were 25. They were supposed to be 25 milligrams each. So we test the raw material, make sure it's good, take it out of quarantine, and then it moves into production, and we do our own intabulation. And then once we have the tablets ready, we take a few of them, and then we test those to make sure that they actually hit the concentration. And I think with isoliquitogenin, we were averaging 24 milligrams, and that wasn't good enough for us. Or maybe it was like 23 or 24 milligrams, which technically is within spec, but we don't want to short anyone even by a milligram. So we scrapped that entire batch and redid it. So these are like 100,000 tablets or something like that, that are just being scrapped just to redo it. Because we want to have perfection. And a lot of people wouldn't make that step. We're big enough that we can we can have that level of risk where we can, if we need to, we can scrap a batch, or maybe we can recycle that material because you can still use some of that material if you crush up the tablets and then re-entabulate it. That's totally fine. And I believe that's part of what we did too, but we really want to make sure everything is dosed properly. We're padding everything. So if it's 500 milligrams, it will never be like 495, but it will probably be 505 milligrams just for that extra level of trust. And also for ourselves, like, and I think that's one of the big things why we do what we do. We take these supplements. Like, we've been doing this for the last 10, 15 years too. And we need a good source. And that's where this all came from anyway. So it's a bit of a selfish pursuit in the sense that we're making the best possible supplements for ourselves, and customers also get benefit from that. But I think based on that, we would never get in a scandalous situation because we don't want to be taking scandalous extracts.
Yeah, no, that's I think it's a win-win basically for everyone involved.
Yeah.
And it's a no-brainer. And I think the fact that Nootropics Depot is still, you know, here and being very successful in, you know, in their core business is the testament to, you know, that being the right way to do things.
And there's been a lot of ups and downs and dealing with a lot of the bullshit within this industry and people saying that, you know, Nootropics Depot is overhyped, everyone on the internet is just on the payroll of Nootropics Depot. We see it a lot, but then when I think people actually try it and give us a shot, you're like, okay, this is a little bit different. I can tell this works better. And I've heard that many times. Like, we recently had Joe Cohen on from Self Decode, and I believe, what was the product he was saying? It was Lion's Mane? Yeah, I think it was Lion's Mane. He said he had never really felt anything from Lion's Mane until he tried our Lion's Mane. And if we look at kind of our Lion's Mane chromatographs, and we're getting it from a really professional grow operation in China, but it's being done on logs and it's being done outdoor. So you also get some of these, like, maybe bacteria and yeast in the air that are stressing the mushroom out. And, you know, it's a clean product, but it being grown outdoors in a more natural setting seems to, on our chromatograms, very consistently, there's another peak that doesn't exist. And yeah.
Yeah. Mushrooms are amazing. Like, just the variability in the different metabolites that you can find in mushrooms and different parts of the mushrooms and different substrates that they've grown on and things like that. It is incredible. And then you've got the different ways that you might perform an extract, like whether it's a water extract, or alcohol extract, or both, and then what the compounds that you get in the extract. And it's just variability. And Lion's Mane is a, you know, a very, very interesting mushroom. And then Reishi is another one of my favorites. So Ganoderma lucidum. And just the amount of effort that we went into to try to find a real quality Reishi product back when, you know, that was a very hot topic as part of my more recent research. It was just, it was extremely difficult to find that.
Yeah.
Extremely difficult.
And it's one of the mushrooms that's really hard to grow. So, and I'll get into our, I'm not sure if I've explained our Lion's Mane project at all to you, but
no,
we're doing some cultivation work.
That's going to be very interesting to learn more about.
And cultivating Lion's Mane is pretty easy. It grows from, once you have an inoculated substrate bag, from there it can take like 2 weeks, maybe a month, until you have a really big fruiting body. But with Reishi, it's a completely different story. The total inoculation time is way longer, and then the growth time is really long. Like, it can take 6 months for a Reishi fruiting body to mature. So even doing research on Reishi is tricky, because it takes you at least half a year to even grow your biomass, and then you have to do all of the research. But Lion's Mane, it's a little bit easier. And I, during the pandemic in our house in Phoenix, I had a little mushroom lab set up with a laminar flow hood, and I was doing cloning of some mushrooms and growing some Lion's Mane, and then taking that Lion's Mane and drying it out and taking it to the lab. And then we were extracting different compounds from it. And then we had an idea, okay, if we look at all of these different Heritium erinaceus cultivars, A lot of them have different physical characteristics. Like one might have longer tendrils, one might be a bit more dense, one might be more round. Different colors, different growth rates, different ways in which they respond to temperature. So we had an idea, does that maybe also affect the bioactives? And can we maybe find a cultivar of Heritsia marinaceus that produces a lot of biomass quickly and a lot of bioactives? So kind of finding that holy grail of something that grows really fast, produces a lot of material and a lot of actives. And then we also realized, well, Aritzia marinaceus contains all of these interesting compounds, but so does Heritium coralloides, Heritium americanum, Heritium abiatus. So we decided to take 21 different cultivars and species of Heritium. We cultured them all out and we grew them in a really big tent that we have kind of out in our lobby. And then we did extraction work on those. And we also made an Arenosine A reference standard by separatory HPTLC or HPLC. So we're actually able to pull some of these compounds out on separate columns and then concentrate them. So by doing that, we've been able to do quite a lot of research. And also now, figuring out different extraction methodologies. And one thing we found out, for example, is that the hericinones hate water. Like, even if there's 0.1% water present, they basically won't extract. So if you're doing a traditional water ethanol extract, yeah, you might not actually be pulling out as much of the hericinone as you might want. So we have to figure out ways to use totally anhydrous solvents, which is also difficult because anhydrous ethanol is basically impossible, because it just attracts water so quickly and makes that azeotrope. So that's a bit too complex. But we can look at a few different solvents and then try and optimize. Unfortunately, I think supercritical CO2 won't necessarily work in our case, but there are some other solvents that we can use. But I think what's interesting about mushrooms, it kind of reminds me of the early days of Longevity and nootropics, where there wasn't a lot known yet, and there were a lot of low-hanging fruits to pick. And I think that's kind of where we are at now. And it's so exciting to be able to, with very minimal effort, make huge discoveries. And that's going to get harder and harder as we progress because, the low-hanging fruit has been picked, and now we're up against some real hardcore science. But for now, it's so easy to just figure out, hey, maybe Heritium coralloides produces some more interesting compounds actually than Heritium arenaceus. So should we be taking Heritium arenaceus? Or if we actually want some of the best lion's mane benefits, maybe we have to hop on over to a different species, or maybe we have to start combining species or combining different cultivars, which I also think is interesting from kind of a Western perspective. We get very stuck on this idea of we get one mushroom, it's like the perfect mushroom, we clone it, and then we grow thousands of those from that clone, and there's no genetic diversity in any of them. So you have this mushroom with your set bioactives, and it's always going to be the same. Generation after generation, extract after extract, it's going to be very similar. But maybe it's more interesting to take a bunch of different Heritium arenaceus cultivars. Like maybe you just grow 20 different ones at a time, and then you blend all of those together and you extract them. And maybe that's one way in which you can achieve a higher degree of bioactive diversity, especially if you start mixing in different species. And if you look at how in the Eastern, more in Asian countries, how a lot of this is being done, I don't think it's all clones of each other. I think it's a bit more wild. I think there's more open pollination happening and more genetic diversity. And I think that yields some interesting results because every time I try some of these mushrooms from China that are coming from what we know are like long-standing mushroom growing facilities that probably have hundreds of years of knowledge on how to cultivate mushrooms in this particular manner. Because, for example, the mushroom cultivation in human history is pretty recent. Like it's from the last 50 years or so, like indoor cultivation of mushrooms, how a lot of us are doing it. But if you look at reishi, apparently they were doing that hundreds of years ago. They already figured out how to grow it. And people in China have access to that knowledge, and I don't think we necessarily know what they know. So there's been this whole sentiment of like, Chinese mushrooms are bad. You should get them from a lab in America with like no diversity of bacteria and yeasts in the air, no fluctuating temperatures. It's all the same exact humidity. It's all the same exact temperature. It's the same exact light. It's the same exact air. It's the same exact clone. Maybe we're moving backwards a little bit there, and we should look for a bit more genetic diversity. And that's why mushrooms are super fascinating.
Diversity, I think, is very important in that. And I think that's probably the same across other areas of research as well. But yeah, I think, look, I think the research into mushrooms over the next decade or so is going to be very, very interesting. I really think we're kind of just scratching the surface as to, the possibilities of what they can do. Immunomodulation is obviously a very big factor, but there's, so many different things that reishi, for example, can do for, mitochondrial metabolism and very specific things for certain, like herpes viruses and things. So there's quite an area of research that just really needs to be focused on around some of these different species. But, I think, time and funding and these things will happen. But
What has your focus been with your research on Rishi?
Well, reishi, when I first started getting interested in reishi, it was for Epstein-Barr virus and also for just a number of the different things that Epstein-Barr virus does to evade the immune response. And what reishi was able to do for Epstein-Barr virus and more the point for the host metabolism and the immune response to Epstein-Barr virus. So where that got difficult though was trying to understand, which reishi products were going to contain the particular triterpenes and things that I was finding in these research papers that would have the effect that I was chasing for use in the protocols that we were developing at that time. And it became quite a task to then research all these different products and, put them on the HPLC and LC-MS, find the ones that actually had like the things that we're looking for. And yeah, it kind of made a whole lot more sense later when I also then came across a USP study, and I think it was published in Nature, which showed that 75% of the reishi products on the market were faked or mislabeled. And it was like suddenly it made sense why we were just not seeing uniform results across the board with people's response to reishi in these circumstances. But once we standardized then on a known good quantity, then things became reliable. So it's yeah, but it's a very, very interesting. I mean, look, reishi gets explored for anti-aging functions. It gets used for just general health and immunomodulation. We use it specifically to promote immune activity towards, again, like herpes viruses and things. But in general, as we actually we normally were previously combining it with lion's mane, but the beta glucans from lion's mane. And that combination was very interesting. So the lion's mane beta glucans would promote like the NK cell proliferation. And meanwhile, we would then set up the signaling for the immune response with reishi to then prioritize certain pathogens or a certain immune response. But that combination together was extremely potent. And it would take somebody whose immune system was more or less ignoring a number of co-infections that were, slumbering infections and force the immune system to actually target them. So somebody would take these mushrooms, they would then get very sick. So the immune system would actually ramp up and start attacking these pathogens. The person would feel like they've got, probably one of the most horrible flus that they've had for a long time, possibly end up in bed for a week or two, and then they'd come out the other end of it and feel, better than they had for a very long time. So it was a very, very useful way to clear, a chronic infection that the immune system hadn't been able to clear. But we had to kind of set up the stage first and, try and get a number of the nutrients and things back into the system, which then allowed the energy metabolism to work, which then allowed the immune cells to make use of that energy metabolism and then yeah, go after some of these old infections. So it's as far as longevity goes, I mean, look, my recent research has been focusing on ME/CFS, so myalgic encephalomyelitis, chronic fatigue syndrome. And then as we moved along from there, that then became long COVID, which was SARS-CoV-2 mediated ME/CFS, and of course the COVID-19 vaccine injuries, which have all of the same symptoms as long COVID and ME/CFS, just with a different vector. So what I was looking into there was the way that ultimately co-infections which were hiding inside of biofilms, and these are like microbial co-infections, was then allowing a persistent state of disease. So we had these reservoirs of these pathogens that the immune system was not able to detect, let alone remediate, because there is a blind spot in the immune system for the contents of these biofilms. And then where that played into things like longevity as well, there were all sorts of really interesting things to come out of that research conceptually, because things like the collagen synthesis and you know, collagen degradation issues that we see in aging, we were also seeing in CFS or long COVID. And you know, you take like a 20-year-old who suddenly looks like they've gained 20 years and they've got that wrinkly skin and, you know, they've got like the Ehlers-Danlos syndrome type, you know, collagen synthesis issues and all these things that are just like, it's like rapid onset aging in what was a previously healthy person. Although, you know, the fact that they might not have been showing, you know, outward symptoms or things that they would think of as a chronic illness, you know, is probably another or a later conversation. But what really seems to be interesting, though, is that in the process of studying chronic fatigue syndrome, it appears that what I've been studying is essentially describing something that either accelerates the aging mechanism or drives the aging mechanism. So all of the symptoms, all these things that we would think of as quote unquote normal metabolism for an 80-year-old were exactly what I was seeing in a 20-year-old with long COVID or ME/CFS. And so if we were able to reverse these issues in a 20-year-old and we restore the collagen synthesis and they're able to get their energy metabolism back line, the histamine issues have gone, the neurotransmitters are back, they're not suffering from anxiety and depression, all of these problems are gone, the cholesterols have gone down, the B6 elevations are gone, all these things are resolved. What happens if we take an 80-year-old or 90-year-old or whatever and we put them through the same process and we get all of the collagen synthesis metabolism and things working again? The question then becomes, like, how far are we able to turn all of that back? And look, it's an open question that I'll hopefully have more data on over, you know, coming years. But the early indications is that this appears to be quite an exciting area to be looking at and to be modeling. So where we are at the moment with that is that we have actually been able to succeed in early testing in reversing long COVID, ME/CFS, and these C19 vaccine injuries reliably. And it's not by, you know, treating the catalyst. Like there's all these different things. And you'll find, look, other common things that you'll find is that there are a number of other named diseases. Like you'll have, you know, post-finasteride syndrome. You'll have, we're talking about lion's mane. There's already a that you'll find on Reddit with lion's mane recovery group and things like that, because it has the ability to act as a catalyst to create this cascade, because it alters the immune system for a period of time that in a complex environment of co-infections allows this particular cascade to progress to a point where they then snowball off and fall off the cliff into this trap. And then and likewise,
does that have something to do with the biofilms that you were mentioning earlier?
Yes,
too?
Okay. Entirely to do with biofilms. And so what my research basically shows is that there are two major blind spots in our immune systems. So one of them relates to these microorganisms, and so that's these biofilms that they create. So that's like an extracellular matrix, these proteins that are like 3D matrix that's around these microbial cells, which then allows them to still, you know, absorb nutrients that are circulating and produce these metabolites, sometimes toxic if they're a pathogen, but basically evade any kind of immune surveillance. They're still susceptible to certain things, but largely other microorganisms, which are then able to produce certain toxic compounds that might either break down, you know, biofilms or inhibit certain pathogenic species. So there's like an ongoing daily war between all of these different microorganisms to then maintain some kind of balance. Anyway, I'll come back to that. The other blind spot in the immune system, well, other major one, and I'm sure there's probably more, is to do with the herpes viruses and HIV and HPV viruses, where there is a latent and a lytic state to the viruses. So we have latency when the viruses are not replicating actively. They still are producing viral antigens and things, but not in any way triggering an immune response. So it's kind of like having a sleepy, smoldering infection where you might have, you know, it might start with one infected cell in a tissue, and then via, like, for example, transcytosis, that one infected cell over many decades might slowly spread out and infect, you know, the entire tissue. And that might be a very, very, very slow process. But because the immune surveillance is not intervening in any way, it's not relevant really up until the point where something triggers those latent cells to become lytic. And what my modeling did is basically uncover a number of the influences and a certain metabolic state, which then causes the reactivation of the herpes viruses. And this is where, for example, you're seeing like all of the shingles, you know, reactivations and cases and things, you know, after COVID or the you know, COVID vaccines, or we're seeing Epstein-Barr virus reactivations and all of these other things. And it's funny because it plays into this whole history of, you know, chronic health issues that people would have seen and maybe not understood, you know, how they were leading to this state. So things like you've probably heard that, you know, probably 30% of the female population suffer from iron deficiency, and it's a smaller percentage of the male population for, you know, obvious reasons, you know, menstrual cycle differences, men don't have one, and other certain reasons. But the other thing is also just the surface area for biofilms in a female body is a larger vector than it is in a male body. You know, there's a larger mucosal surface area, so the ability, or, you know, for biofilms to expand and grow over a surface is significantly higher. So that unfortunately means that women are overrepresented in the chronic illness spectrum because of that vector, in my opinion.
And where do these biofilms, where are these present then? And how do they largely grow?
How do they grow? So even normal healthy bacteria, so beneficial bacteria will produce biofilms, and there are different types of biofilms. All of these different species will produce different structures, and sometimes you will have a number of different species will come together inside of one biofilm, and they will produce a different type of biofilm by their combination, and that different type of biofilm might be more resilient against things that might otherwise break down biofilms. A number of things that we do, like daily activities and certain things that are in our diets, will actually help us degrade these biofilms and keep turning them over. So if you could imagine that if the biofilms are broken down, then the immune surveillance gets an opportunity to inspect the contents and make decisions about what stays and what goes, providing, of course, the immune system's not otherwise distracted or busy with other antigens, like viral antigens, for example. So otherwise, normally, these microbes that are hiding inside these biofilms, once they mature and they proliferate, they come out of the biofilms, they disperse, and then they look for a new surface to adhere to, and then start producing more biofilms, they lose their motility, and then this whole cycle goes, you know, and repeats. So that's the planktonic stage when they're mobile or motile. If the immune system is not available there to provide that checkpoint because it's busy or because there are certain things that are causing someone to be immunocompromised, then the surface area of those biofilms or pathogenic biofilms becomes, you know, a real issue. So it's a way that they can rapidly expand. So one of the things that was really interesting about getting COVID or these vaccine injuries is that the spike protein is able to create this clotting issue. That clotting issue creates hypoxia. The hypoxia is one of the triggers which leads to the reactivation of these herpes viruses. And then on top of just having SARS-CoV-2 or persistent spike protein generation by, you know, some kind of, you know, emergency use product, you then end up with the herpes virus antigens now continuing to distract the immune system, just like the previous virus or the pseudovirus that triggered it to be reactivated in the first place. And so the long COVID, you would have, you know, a much longer period of post-viral fatigue and post-viral symptoms, because you've now had your previous, you know, sort of latent viral infections now reactivated, or you've now had significant growth of these biofilms to the point that the immune system is now busy dealing with these other co-infections. So in that way, the SARS-CoV-2, it's not that it's a particularly scary, you know, pathogen. It's the fact that it has the capacity to wake up the slumbering beasts and to stir up the immune system in a way where, you know, it just lets the underlying co-infections loose to take over the host. So it's been very, very interesting to see. It's the amount of data that the last few years has given us in actually, you know, being able to understand some of the pathophysiology for this disease has been just incredible. Like I never, if it hadn't been for this pandemic and some of the decisions that came along after that, the data would not have been available to allow us to perform this kind of modeling.
Yeah, this is something I sometimes say to Erica, like you need a dramatic event sometimes to drive innovation. Whether that is something as horrible as war, where a lot of innovations are like even just agricultural innovations and things like that, all came from kind of the Second World War. We didn't have enough food. How do we rectify that problem? Hey, synthetic fertilizers. And that's a good thing and a bad thing. Now we're finding out, but at the time it kind of saved humanity. Sometimes we need this trigger, and COVID obviously was a huge trigger for all sorts of innovation. And
Rapid
I think,
development.
yeah. And one really positive thing that I saw is that a lot of people who previously had no interest in biology or how their body worked or supplements or any of that, after COVID, they started getting interested in it because they got basically health education. Like I even see my parents, what was his name? Dr. Campbell. I don't know if you watched him at all on YouTube.
Oh, not very much. A
So
very
they
interesting
were
journey.
Yeah, and they were a huge fan of it, and they were watching the videos, and they started picking up this language, which now allowed me to communicate with them, like in kind of my scientific language. And it's cool to be able to connect with people now through something horrible that affected all of us, but also drove a lot of innovation. And I think an interesting thing with scientific research is that basically all of the COVID research is freely accessible. So none of it is behind a paywall, even if it's with very notorious journals like Elsevier, which basically never has anything available for free, and it's always hard to find it on Sci-Hub. They're very good with hiding their research, but for COVID, it was just all out in the open. So even if something was very minorly related to it, boom, it was just all open. And I think, and I hope in the future, Elsevier and Nature sees this as an opportunity to maybe allow more people to read these studies and not have it always be behind a paywall.
Yeah, I think, look, really, we kind of need to take a step back as humanity and say, look, if this is our collective project as a species to try to understand cell biology and nature and the universe, why is it that we think it's even remotely acceptable that this information should be locked up behind paywalls in the first place? Why is it that we have journals that are collecting vast amounts of money essentially to run a giant database and website? This makes absolutely no sense.
And none of
It's
it is
just
going back into the
curious.
actual research. Because I was telling you the other day on one of our phone calls, I had a conversation with someone at Stanford, and they're developing a potential new drug for OCD, which is, I think, the third most prevalent mental health disorder. And there isn't a really good way to treat it. And basically, the thing standing between her research and a potential cure is a couple $100,000. But
It's
these
ridiculous.
journals are just collecting millions and millions of dollars, and what really needs to happen is that some of these funds need to be opened up to researchers actually doing the research, because those researchers don't have the money to do the research, even though they're at a prestigious institute like Stanford, and that's really hard. And we see it too, because like we came out with our Cognance like acid hydrolyzed bacopa extract, and we would love to do some human clinical trials on it, but I'm sure as you've discovered too, it's very expensive to do that.
Yeah.
And
Well, we're
it's not
processed
always
again.
worth doing it.
Well, that's very interesting. And we could have another longer conversation around, how potentially some of the old longevity days has transformed into some of the ways that I have been conducting my research. But ultimately the outcomes of that. And it's kind of it is an interesting thing to consider because like under normal circumstances, to do the things that I have done over the last few years would have taken probably 40 years and probably $300 million worth of funding just to achieve things that I've been able to do in, a matter of months. So it's I think we kind of need to take a step back and just look at the way things are, the how things are being conducted, because I don't think it really is leading to a positive outcome. And it kind of leads to this stagnation that we have at the moment. But then also just from an informatics point of view, we have all of these studies coming out. And they are really wonderful at describing it like a single data point, like one enzyme and one particular function of an enzyme under a certain condition, that ultimately then just sits there until somebody decides to pick it up and says, hey, actually, how does that actually fit into a bigger picture, of a system? You know, no one's been really looking at this from a systematic angle. And I think, look, as you know, the machine learning and things continue to develop, that will get easier and easier, because ultimately, if you have some sort of GPT-like instance going through, hopefully not hallucinating, and then going through and crunching everything and actually turning it into a like an actual system, then yeah, then it becomes actually usable. So what my work has been is a human version of GPT going through and actually taking all of these isolated data points and saying, well, okay, what happens if we put all this together? What does it actually tell us? How does this work? And then being able to tease out the logic of some of these pathways under certain conditions to a point where suddenly it actually everything clicks. And that's what we've been able to do. And then, yeah, use that to then develop a protocol, which is continuing to be developed and refined and improved, but has been able to transform people's lives and take them back from feeding tubes and palliative care back to, you know, enjoying a normal life. You know, whereas previously that has just been impossible to do.
Yeah, then I think with the, would you call yourself a citizen scientist,
mean,
as that's sometimes
that's a good
described?
label. I'm happy to wear that label. It's funny that there are so many, I don't know, there's like a stigma attached to somebody who's not attached to an institution or doesn't go through a traditional pathway, you know, to reach a, you know, a credential, which then supposedly allows them to research a topic, you know, whereas in many cases, the solutions don't come from within, they come from outside. And that's simply because somebody who hasn't had the classical training to look at a particular problem through a set of eyes, through a lens, sees it from a different angle and is able to, you know, to say, oh, okay, actually, maybe there's another way that this works. You know, my background, separate to, you know, my interest in biochemistry, came from an engineering background, and so and systems and IT. So being able to look at things through that sort of lens has allowed me to see things probably very, very differently than somebody that looks at it, you know, from a more traditional medical realm.
Absolutely. I think that's, now that you describe yourself as coming from an engineering background, my dad is also coming out of that world, and I grew up with a lot of that kind of sentiment and way of thinking about the world. And I think that's honestly why I was so attracted to your uridine DHA thread and the approach you were taking. You weren't just going, oh, these compounds fit well together, that's it. Don't question it, just take it. You really went through an 83-page thread to really dig through all of the mechanisms, communicate with other people, and collect data points just from people on the internet, and then take that and develop it into something more fleshed out. And I think that your approach and what I saw in longevity really inspired me to take a more professional approach, because I was supplementing myself. But then also reading some of your threads and reading some of Paul's threads and seeing kind of the differences there. And then eventually when I did join Nootropics Depot, one thing I always wanted to do is make an all-in-one Mr. Happy Stack. We did end up doing that in Omega Tau, but I think Omega Tau was an exercise for me to really perfect my formulating, and kind of looking at how you were doing it back in the day and hearing how you're still doing it. And I think it's really important, and I try and hammer this point home a lot, is if you find a study that one compound has an effect on this specific dopamine receptor, it doesn't mean that's all it's doing. There's a lot more around it. And even if, like, for example, you're blocking the adenosine A2A receptor, it forms heterodimers with the dopamine D2 receptor. So if you turn off the adenosine A2A, it turns on the dopamine D2. So then that's already a level of complexity that becomes hard to even wrap your head around. And that's just a little thing. Now you have to think of all of the signaling cascades that happen when you actually activate these dopamine receptors, and some of the stuff that's going in on your gut. And I think it's really important that this research is happening outside of institutions, because when I've had conversations with people at institutions and I tell them all of this anecdotal data that is just widely available on Longevity and Reddit, where people are trying these things out on themselves in certain disease states sometimes, and saying like, this is exactly what it does, and keeping notes and being able to look there. And I think that citizen scientist approach is really important. And the coin really dropped for me when our lab director, our previous lab director, he's really into astronomy. And he kept saying, you guys should come out on an astronomy trip. just out in the middle of the desert. It's going to be me, a bunch of guys from the University of Arizona, and we'll have a great time, just camp out there, look at some stars and things like that. So we kind of showed up totally not expecting that, like, 60% of the people there were hardcore citizen scientists, and they're working on exoplanets and things like that. And they were basically telling us, the reason NASA knows so much about exoplanets is not because NASA is doing the research on exoplanets. It's because there's a shitload of citizen scientists who are spending enormous amounts of time and money building out their kit. Like, some of the telescopes we were looking through and some of the imaging that they were doing and the computer programs and the complexity of it all, it really blew my mind. Like, this, I thought it was going to be kind of a kumbaya. We're sitting around a fire, getting stoned, looking at, you know, the stars. But this was a hardcore scientific exercise, and note taking was being done. And it made me realize, we know this stuff about space because of citizen scientists. But we also know a lot about what's going on internally in our own brain because of citizen scientists. And we also know a lot about mushrooms, for example, because of citizen scientists. There's a guy in the US called William Padilla Brown, and he's one of the people who first found a way to properly cultivate cordyceps mushrooms, and he's doing a lot of this mushroom work. And because of him, we know more about cordyceps. Because of you, we know more about biofilms. We know about the combinations of certain nutrients, and just everyone discussing together, I think, makes a very interesting data pool that you then have to do something with. And I think that's kind of what you're working on now.
Well, this is just it. I mean, what I tend to do is I start off with the literature. So we've got foundational where we can understand that we have a known footprint of, you know, a number of different variables, but there's also an expectation that there are going to be perhaps, you know, other papers that may have been missed, which, you know, show some additional footprint, or there might be some unexpected things that just haven't been quantified yet. So then taking that information, modeling it, turning it into something that, you know, okay, we now have a target, we can measure certain metabolites, we can look at different, you know, different aspects of it, and then going through some experimental procedures to actually try to better understand it and try to understand, you know, if there's, you know, things that have been missed. Now, some of my earlier research, so the 2021 sort of era, I was kind of more myopically focused on the herpes viruses and thinking that was, you know, the be all and end all of studying this stuff. I would say in retrospect that while that was a very interesting topic, I had kind of really missed a very large part of the picture, which then took me another, you know, few years to continue exploring until just pulling at the, you know, the strings of this puzzle until it continued to unfold and unravel.